Chapter 4. I returned to health slowly, and even when no longer confined to my bed, my brain remained in a sort of stupor, and for a long time I could not quite understand what had happened to me. There were moments when it seemed to me that I was dreaming, and I remember I longed that all that was happening might really turn into a dream. And as I fell asleep at night, I hoped that I might somehow wake up in our poor garret and see father and mother. But at last my position grew clear to me, and little by little I understood that I had become utterly alone and was living with strangers. Then, for the first time, I felt that I was an orphan. At first I looked eagerly at all the new things that so suddenly surrounded me. At first everything seemed strange and wonderful, everything bewildered me. The new faces, the new habits, and the rooms of the old princely mansion, large, lofty, and richly furnished as I see now, but so gloomy and forbidding that I remember I was genuinely afraid to make my way across the long, long drawing-room, in which I felt that I should be utterly lost. My illness had not yet quite passed off, and my impressions were gloomy, oppressive, in perfect keeping with this solemnly dignified, gloomy abode. Moreover, a depression I did not myself understand grew stronger and stronger in my little heart. I would stop in amazement before a picture, a looking-glass, a fireplace of cunning workmanship, or a statue which seemed to be hiding in some secluded niche on purpose to keep better watch on me and frighten me. I would stop and suddenly forget why I had stopped, what I wanted, what I had begun thinking about, and only when I came to myself, I was sometimes overwhelmed by dread and perplexity. Of those who from time to time came to see how I was when I was lying ill in bed, besides the old doctor, the one who impressed me most was a man, rather elderly, very serious, but very kind, who looked at me with deep compassion. I liked his face better than all the others. I longed to speak to him, but was afraid. He always looked depressed, spoke in brief snatches, and there was never a trace of a smile on his lips. This was Prince X, who had found me and was caring for me in his house. When I began to get better, his visits became less and less frequent. The last time he came, he brought me sweets, a child's picture book, kissed me, made the sign of the cross over me, and begged me to be more cheerful. To comfort me, he told me that I should soon have a companion, his daughter, Katya, a little girl like me who was now in Moscow. Then, after saying something to a middle-aged Frenchwoman, his children's nurse, and to the maid who looked after me, he commended me to them, went out, and from that time I did not see him for 3 weeks. The prince lived in complete solitude in his house. The princess lived in the larger part of the house. She, too, sometimes saw nothing of the prince for weeks together. Later on, I noticed that all the members of the household hardly spoke of him, as though he were not in the house at all. They all respected him and loved him, too. One could see that, and yet looked upon him as a strange and queer man. It seemed as though he realized himself that he was very odd, somehow, not like other people, and so tried to keep out of their sight as much as possible. I shall have occasion to say a great deal and in much more detail about him. One morning they dressed me in fine white linen, put me into a black woollen frock with white pleureuse, at which I gazed with a sort of dejected wonder, combed my hair, and took me downstairs to the princess's apartments. I stood petrified with wonder when I was taken into her. I had never before seen such wealth and magnificence around me. But that impression was momentary, and I turned pale when I heard the princess's voice bidding them bring me nearer. Even while I was being dressed, I thought that I was being prepared for some painful ordeal, though God only knows how such an idea was suggested to me. Altogether, I entered upon my new life with a strange distrust of everything surrounding me. But the princess was very gracious with me, and kissed me. I looked at her a little more boldly. It was the same lovely lady whom I had seen when I regained consciousness. But I was trembling all over when I kissed her hand, and could not pluck up courage enough to answer her questions. She told me to sit down on a low stool near her. I think this place had been assigned me beforehand. One could see that the princess wished for nothing better than to care for me with her whole heart, to pet me, and to take the place of a mother to me completely. But I was utterly unable to understand my good fortune, and did nothing to gain her good opinion. I was given a fine picture-book, and told to look at it. The princess was writing a letter. From time to time she put down her pen and talked to me again. But I was confused and perplexed, and said nothing sensible. In fact, though my story was very exceptional, and fate, moving in all sorts of mysterious ways, undoubtedly played a great part in it, and in fact there was much in it that was interesting, inexplicable, and even fantastic, yet I myself turned out, as though in despite of these melodramatic surroundings, a most ordinary child, scared, as it were, crushed, and even rather stupid. The last characteristic the princess disliked particularly, and I think she was thoroughly sick of me in a little while, for which I blame myself entirely, of course. Between 2 and 3 o'clock, visitors began to arrive, and the princess suddenly became more attentive and affectionate to me. To the questions asked about me, she answered that it was an extremely interesting story, and then began to tell it in French. As she told the story, her visitors looked at me, shook their heads and exclaimed. One young man eyed me through his lorgnette. One grey-headed and scented old gentleman would have kissed me, while I turned pale and red, and sat with my eyes cast down, afraid to stir, and trembling in every limb. My heart ached. My mind went back to the past, to our garret. I thought of my father, our long silent evenings. Mother, and when I thought of mother, tears welled up into my eyes. There was a lump in my throat, and I longed to run away, to disappear, to be alone. Then, when the visitors had gone, the princess's face became noticeably colder. She looked at me more crossly, spoke more abruptly, and I was particularly frightened by her piercing black eyes, sometimes fixed on me for a quarter of an hour at a stretch, and her tightly compressed lips. In the evening I was taken upstairs. I fell asleep in a fever, woke up in the night miserable and crying at delirious dreams. Next morning there was the same business, and I was taken to the princess again. At last she seemed herself tired of telling her visitors about my adventures, and the visitors tired of commiserating me. Besides, I was such an ordinary child, entirely without simplicity. As I remember the princess herself expressed, in a tête-à-tête to a middle-aged lady, who asked her whether she was not bored with me. And behold, one evening I was taken away, not to be brought back again. So ended my career as favourite. I was allowed, however, to go about the house freely, wherever I liked. I could not sit still in the same place, I was so intensely, morbidly miserable, and I was very, very glad when at last I could get away from everyone into the big rooms downstairs. I remember that I had a great longing to talk to the servants, but I was so afraid of annoying them that I preferred to remain alone. The way I liked best to pass my time was to retreat into some corner where I was more out of sight, to stand behind some piece of furniture and there at once begin recalling and imagining all that had happened. But, strange to say, I seem to have forgotten the ending of my life with my parents and all that terrible time. Pictures flitted before my eyes, facts stood out. I did remember it all, really. The night, the violin and father. I remembered how I had got him the money. But somehow I could not interpret, could not explain all that had happened. Only there was a weight on my heart, and when in my memories I came to the moment when I said my prayers beside my dead mother, a cold shiver ran all over me. I trembled, uttered a faint scream, and then my breathing felt choked, my whole chest ached, and my heart thumped so that I ran out of my corner in a panic. I was wrong, however, in saying that they left me alone. I was zealously and watchfully looked after, and the instructions of the prince who had directed that I should be given complete freedom and not be restricted in any way, but not be lost sight of for a moment, were scrupulously carried out. I used to notice that from time to time someone of the household would glance into the room in which I was and go away again without saying a word to me. I was much surprised and rather troubled by this attention. I could not understand why this was done. It seemed to me that I was being taken care of for some purpose, and that they meant to do something with me later on. I remember that I was always trying to get farther away, that I might know in case of need where to hide. Once I strayed out onto the front staircase. It was wide, made of marble and covered with carpet, decorated with flowers and beautiful vases. Two tall men, very gaily dressed and wearing gloves and the whitest of cravats, sat in silence on each landing. I gazed at them in amazement, and could not explain to myself why they sat there and did not speak, but simply stared at one another and did nothing. I liked these solitary expeditions more and more. There was, besides, another reason for my running away from upstairs. The prince's old aunt lived on the upper floor, scarcely ever going out. This old lady has left a vivid impression on my memory. She was almost the most important person in the house. Everyone observed a ceremonious etiquette with her, and even the princess, who looked so proud and imperious, had on fixed days, twice a week, to go upstairs and pay a personal visit to the prince's aunt. She usually went in the morning. A frigid conversation began, frequently interrupted by solemn pauses, during which the old lady either murmured a prayer or counted her reckoning beads. The visit did not end till desired by the aunt, who rose from her seat and kissed the princess on the lips, and thereby gave her to understand that the interview was at an end. In the past, the princess had had to visit her husband's aunt every day, but of late, at the old lady's desire, the severity of this rule had been relaxed, and the princess was only obliged on the other 5 days of the week to send every morning to inquire after her health. In fact, the old lady lived like a hermit. She was unmarried, and when she was 35 had retired to a convent, where she spent 17 years but did not take the veil. Then she had left the convent and gone to Moscow to live with her widowed sister, Countess L., who was growing frailer in health year by year, and to be reconciled with her second sister, another unmarried Princess X, with whom she had been on bad terms for over 20 years. But the old ladies are said never to have spent a single day without quarrelling. Thousands of times they were on the point of parting and could not bring themselves to do so, because they realized at last that each of them was necessary to the other two, to ward off boredom and the infirmities of old age. But in spite of the unattractiveness of their manner of life, and the ceremonial boredom that reigned in their Moscow mansion, the whole town looked upon it as a duty not to discontinue visiting the three recluses. They were looked upon as the guardians of all the sanctities and traditions of aristocracy, and as living relics of the old nobility. Countess L. was an excellent woman, and many good things were remembered of her. People called on them first on arriving from Petersburg. Anyone who was received in their house was received everywhere. But the Countess died, and the remaining sisters parted. The elder princess remained in Moscow to inherit her share of the fortune of the Countess, who died without children, while the younger settled with her nephew, Prince X, in Petersburg. On the other hand, the prince's two children, Katya and Alexandra, were visiting their great-aunt at Moscow to entertain and console her in her solitude. Their mother, who loved her children passionately, did not dare to utter a word of protest at being parted from them for the whole period assigned for mourning. I have forgotten to mention that the prince's whole house was still in mourning when I came to live in it, but the time for it was soon over. The old princess was dressed always in black, always in gowns of plain woollen stuff, and wore starched pleated collars which made her look like an inmate of an almshouse. She did not give up wearing the rosary, drove out in solemn state to mass, observed all the fasts, received visits from various ecclesiastical dignitaries and pious personages, read holy books, and altogether led the life of a nun. The stillness on the upper floor was terrible. One dared not let a door creak. The old lady's senses were as keen as though she were a girl of 15, and she sent immediately to find out the cause of any noise, even the faintest creak. Everyone spoke in a whisper, everyone walked on tiptoe, and the poor Frenchwoman, herself an old lady, was obliged to give up her favourite footgear, shoes with high heels. Heels were banished. A fortnight after my arrival, the old princess sent to inquire who I was, what I was like, how I had come into the house, and so on. Her curiosity was immediately and respectfully gratified. Then a second messenger was sent to the French lady to inquire why she, the old princess, had not yet seen me. At once there was a great to-do. They began combing my hair, washing my face and hands, which were already very clean, showing me how to walk in, how to bow, how to look more good-humoured and gracious, how to speak. In fact, I was regularly tormented. Then an envoy was sent from our part of the house to inquire whether the great lady cared to see the little orphan. The answer that followed was in the negative, but another time, the following day after Mass, was fixed. I did not sleep all night, and I was told afterwards that I was light-headed all night, and raving of going to the old princess and begging her forgiveness for something. At last my presentation arrived. I saw a spare little old lady sitting in a huge easy chair. She nodded her head to me and put on her spectacles to look at me more closely. I remember that she did not like me at all. It was observed that I was quite a savage, that I did not know how to curtsy nor kiss hands. Questions followed, and I scarcely answered them. But when allusion was made to my father and mother, I began to cry. The old lady was much displeased at my display of feeling. However, she began trying to console me, telling me to put my trust in God. Then she asked me when I had last been to church, and as I scarcely understood her question, for my education had been greatly neglected, the old princess was horrified. She sent for her niece. A consultation followed, and it was settled that I should be taken to church on the following Sunday. Till then the old princess undertook to pray for me, but told them to take me away, as, in her own words, I had made a very painful impression on her. There was nothing strange in that. It was bound to be so. But it was evident that she did not like me at all. The same day word was sent that I was too noisy in my play and could be heard all over the house, though, as I sat all day long without moving, this must have been the old lady's fancy. Yet the same message came next day. It happened about that time that I dropped a cup and broke it. The French governess and all the servants were in despair, and I was immediately sent to a room at the farther end of the house, where they all followed me in a state of panic. I don't know how the incident ended. This was why I was glad to get downstairs and wander about the great rooms, knowing that there I should disturb no one. I remember I was sitting one day in a big drawing-room downstairs. I hid my face in my hands, bowed my head, and sat like that I don't remember how many hours. I kept thinking and thinking. My immature mind was unable to analyze my misery, and I felt more dreary and sick at heart every day. Suddenly a voice rang out over me.
"What's the matter with you, my poor child?"
I raised my head. It was the prince. His gaze expressed deep sympathy and compassion. But I gazed at him with such a crushed, unhappy air that tears came into his big blue eyes.
"Poor little orphan,"
he said, patting me on the head.
"No, no, not an orphan, no," I said,
and a moan broke from me, and everything surged up in me and rose to the surface. I got up from my seat, clutched at his hand, and, kissing it and wetting it with my tears, repeated in an imploring voice,
"No, no, not an orphan, no!"
"My child, what is the matter with you, my dear? What is it, poor Nietochka?"
"Where is my mother? Where is my mother?"
I cried, sobbing loudly, unable to conceal my misery any longer, and helplessly falling on my knees before him.
"Please tell me where my mother is!"
"Forgive me, my child. Oh, poor little thing. I have reminded her. What have I done? Come. Come along with me, Nyatochka. Come along with me.
He took me by the hand and led me along with him quickly. He was moved to the depths of his soul. At last we reached a room which I had not seen before. It was the icon room. It was dusk. The lamps gleamed brightly, with their lights reflected on the golden settings and precious stones of the icons. The faces of the saints looked out dimly from the gold mountings. Everything here was so unlike the other rooms, so mysterious and gloomy, that I was much impressed and overcome by a sort of terror. Besides, I was in such a morbid condition. The prince quickly made me kneel down before the icon of the Mother of God, and knelt down beside me.
Pray, my child, pray. We will both pray,
he said in a soft, broken voice. But I could not pray. I was overwhelmed, even terrified. I remembered my father's words that last night beside my mother's body, and I had a nervous seizure. I lay in bed ill, and in this second period of my illness I almost died. This was how it happened. One day a familiar name sounded in my ears. I heard the name of S. Someone of the household pronounced the name by my bedside. I started. Memories came rushing upon me, and, overwhelmed by recollections, dreams, and distress, I lay for I don't know how many hours in real delirium. I woke up very late. It was dark all round me. The nightlight had gone out, and the girl who used to sit in my room was not there. All at once, I heard the sound of faraway music. At times the music died away entirely, at times grew more and more distinct, as though it were coming nearer. I don't remember what feeling came over me, what project sprang up in my sick brain. I got out of bed, and I don't know how I found strength to do it, but I dressed in my mourning and went groping through the rooms. I found no one in the next room, nor in the room beyond. At last I made my way into the corridor. The sounds were becoming more and more distinct. In the middle of the corridor there was a staircase leading down. That was the way by which I always went down to the big rooms. The staircase was brightly lighted up. People were walking about below. I hid in a corner to avoid being seen, and only when it was possible went downstairs to the second corridor. The music was coming from the drawing room near. In it there was noise and talk, as though thousands of people were assembled. One of the drawing-room doors leading out of the corridor was draped with two curtains of crimson velvet. I raised the outer one and stood between the two. My heart beat so violently that I could hardly stand. But a few minutes later, mastering my agitation, I ventured to move a little aside the border of the second curtain. My goodness! The immense gloomy room which I was so afraid to enter was gleaming now with a thousand lights. It was like a sea of light flowing upon me, and my eyes, accustomed to the darkness, were at first painfully dazzled. The perfumed air fanned my face like a hot wind. Masses of people were walking to and fro. It seemed as though all had gay and joyful faces. The women were in such rich, such light dresses. On all sides I saw eyes sparkling with delight. I stood as though spellbound. It seemed to me as though I had seen all this somewhere in a dream. There came back into my mind the dusk, our garret, the high window, the street far down below with the glittering lampposts, the windows of the house opposite with the red curtains, the carriages densely packed at the doors, the stamping and snorting of the proud horses, the shouts, the noise, the shadows of the windows, and the faint, distant music. So here, here was that paradise, flashed through my mind. This was where I wanted to go with my poor father. So it was not a dream. Yes, I had seen it all before in my dreams, in my fancies. My imagination, inflamed by illness, took fire, and tears of inexplicable rapture streamed from my eyes. I looked about for my father. "He must be here. He is here," I thought, and my heart beat with anticipation. I could hardly breathe. But the music ceased. A hum of voices began, and a murmur arose from all parts of the room. I gazed eagerly into the faces that flashed by me and tried to recognize someone. All at once an extraordinary excitement was apparent in the room. I saw a tall, lean old man on a raised platform. His pale face was smiling. He bent his angular figure, bowing in all directions. A profound silence followed, as though all these people were holding their breath. All eyes were fixed on the old man. All was expectant. He raised his violin and touched the strings with his bow. The music began, and I felt all at once as though something were clutching my heart. In intense anguish, holding my breath, I listened to those sounds. Something familiar was sounding in my ears, as though I had somewhere heard this before. Some foreboding of something awful, horrible, was reflected in my heart. At last the violin vibrated more loudly. The notes resounded faster and more shrilly. It was like a despairing wail, a pitiful lamentation, as though some prayer were being uttered in vain in all that crowd and dying away, ceasing in despair. Something more and more familiar was taking shape in my heart, but my heart refused to believe it. I clenched my teeth to keep back a moan of pain. I clutched at the curtain that I might not fall. From time to time I closed my eyes and suddenly opened them, expecting that it was a dream, that I should wake up at some terrible moment I knew already, and that I was dreaming of that last night and bearing those same sounds. Opening my eyes, I tried to reassure myself. I looked eagerly into the crowd. No, these were different people, different faces. It seemed as though they were all, like me, expecting something. All, like me, suffering agony. That they all wanted to scream at those fearful moans and wails to stop, not to tear their hearts. But the wails and moans flowed on, more agonizing, more plaintive, more prolonged. Then the last fearful, prolonged cry rang out, and everything in me was shaken. I had no doubt. It was the same cry. I recognized it. I had heard it before. It stabbed me to the heart, as it had on that night. "Father! Father!" flashed like lightning through my brain. "He is here! It's he! He is calling me! It is his violin!" A groan seemed to rise from all that crowd, and terrific applause shook the room. I could restrain myself no longer, threw back the curtain and dashed into the room. "Daddy! Daddy! It is you! Where are you?" I cried, almost beside myself. I don't know how I reached the tall old man. People let me pass. They stood aside to make way for me. I rushed to him with an agonizing shriek. I thought that I was embracing my father. All at once, I saw that long, bony hands had seized me and were lifting me up in the air. Black eyes were fixed upon me, and seemed as though they would scorch me with their fire. I looked at the old man. No, this was not my father. It was his murderer, was the thought that flashed through my brain. I was overwhelmed by frenzy, and all at once it seemed to me as though there were a shout of laughter at me, that laughter was re-echoed in the room in a unanimous roar. I lost consciousness.